The Skippy and Fanny Show is listener supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skippyandfanty, sign up for a 1 month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skippyandfanty and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 146.
Discussion episode, taking the Turing test with Mary Robinette Kowal.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
I'm Julia.
And our special guest is obviously the person that Paul already announced, Mary Robinette Kowal. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So we were going to just talk about puppets. That was like the original topic, but I realize that you've talked about puppets a lot. However, before I just throw that whole thing out, I need to know, what is your favorite puppet movie ever?
Oh, that's easy. It's Strings. Strings the movie. It's a Danish film. It is one of the best science or fantasy world building movies I've ever seen. It's a marionette production in which the marionettes are marionettes. It's a world inhabited by marionettes. And so the strings go up into the heavens, and has lots of fantastic world building details. Like, when you want to bar the gates of the city, you really just put a bar across an opening. None of the buildings have ceilings, because of course that would be impossible with strings. It's beautifully designed and gorgeous, gorgeous manipulation.
And I'm assuming they have subtitles or something for us English people.
It's dubbed into English, actually.
Oh, no dub. All right. Well, I'll put up with it.
Well, but I believe that the main character, the prince, later went on to play a very famous hobbit.
Really?
Yeah. Way before. This is before the Lord of the Rings.
Wow. Well, that's cool. Cool. All right. So that's your favorite puppet-related movie ever. Paul, what's yours?
I'm going to be iconoclastic and say Being John Malkovich. Because it involves a puppeteer.
Interesting. I would not have gone that direction. What about you, Julia?
No one told me there was going to be a quiz. I was not warned. The first thing I thought of was Labyrinth. I don't even know if that's the correct answer for me, but I'm going to go with it.
It's a good movie, though.
It's a great movie, and it has good puppets.
No. I'm going to probably just go with nostalgia, and I'll just say Fraggle Rock. Because I watched that as a child. So it's still my favorite. And I'm going to assume everybody in the podcast has seen Fraggle Rock.
Yes.
Definitely.
I haven't seen the movie of it.
Oh, I meant the TV show. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, you did cheat. Just as long as we're clear, cheating happened.
Yes, I cheated. I'm sorry. okay. So anyway, so that's that. So before we started the podcast, Mary, you had started telling us about this AI that had somehow passed the Turing test, and we stopped you because we wanted to save that for this. So would you please continue your story about the AI that passed the Turing test?
Okay, sure. So the Turing test is, just for people who aren't familiar with it, is a test that's designed to tell whether or not we have achieved artificial intelligence. And it's really simple. You have a human and you have a machine. And then you set up a little blind study thing, and someone comes in and chats with both of them. and if the person who is chatting thinks that the computer is more human than the actual human, then you pass the Turing test. So there's a thing called the Bot Prize, which is designed to try and make more lifelike bots. And there's an artificially intelligent virtual gamer that was created by computer scientists at the University of Texas in Austin. And it won the Bot Prize by convincing a panel of judges that it was, in fact, more human-like than over half of the people it competed against.
That's so creepy.
Isn't that a little creepy? Yeah.
Now, that's amazing.
Yeah. I so love this stuff. Now, the official Loebner Prize, I'm not sure I'm saying that right, L-O-E-B-N-E-R, which has been the one that has been running the Turing tests since 91, has not actually had anyone win. They award a bronze prize every year, but the gold and silver haven't been won. The silver is for text only, and the gold is the audiovisual prize.
That's pretty cool. Julia, you wanted to jump in.
So this just reminded me of this fantastic story of, speaking of robots convincing other humans that they are human, not to do with the Turing test, but we are talking about AI, so it's on topic. My partner's coworker actually decided at some point last year that he was just going to have Cleverbot, which is an internet AI thing, respond to any comments on his Facebook wall. And so he didn't tell anyone that he was going to do this. He just let it do it and set it up to respond anytime someone commented. So people would post things like, "Hey, how you doing?" And Cleverbot would be responding with random stuff. And eventually people started to get really upset, because the thing about doing that is that no one you know is actually going to think that it's a bot responding to them. Like, if you haven't been told, you're not going to assume, oh, this isn't my friend or relative, this is a robot. So it started to get really surreal, and there were these threads that would be like, "Hey, how you doing? I am doing. Are you okay? Okay. You don't really sound like yourself. You don't sound like yourself. I'm really worried about you. You really don't sound like yourself. Are you okay? I don't sound like yourself."
Oh, no.
And this went on until, like, at least a few different friends and relatives stormed off and resolved never to speak to him again.
Wow.
So yeah, I just wanted to share that. It's a really messed up thing to do to your friends and family if you decide to, but astonishingly amusing to everyone else.
Isn't there, there's also like a related kind of to this. Wasn't there like a sort of low grade Google type bot where if you typed in a question, it would automatically tell you how to Google it?
Boy, I could give that to so many different people.
I think that's literally what it was. And what people would do is they would, you know, you type in whatever question the person asked, and then you'd give them the link, and it would go in and show them how to do the Google search, which I think is adorable, but maybe not as a friendly way to, and not a great way to make friends, I guess. But that's really interesting. So we're kind of like talking about real world thing, but obviously AIs have been fairly common in science fiction. They've been around, I don't know, 60, 70 years, maybe even much longer than that, depending on our definition of AI, I guess. You want to jump in?
Yeah, sorry, I should have done the hands thing. No, they've been along way before that, actually. There's a French author whose name I'm completely blanking on, but he had... he wrote a science fiction story in which Thomas Edison created an artificial intelligence. And it was while Edison was still around. Early stuff. Ah, darn it. other people talk while I try to find the name of this book, because it's really interesting and I am totally blanking on it.
Yeah,
but it's
I tried Googling it too. I tried.
So did I. It's like, what is this book?
I have it on my shelf in the other room, which is not helpful.
No. So what year roughly was this?
This is late 1800s.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I kind of threw out the 50 to 60 to 70 years, but not thinking also to realize that it's beyond inaccurate because we're in 2013, not 1990.
I was thinking going at least back to Capek and RUR is the first AI that I can think of before hearing about the story that Mary was talking about. You know, and that's in the early 1920s, I believe, is when RUR's comes out, and that's a whole about robots passing as humans, and that's all in a sense all about the Turing test. Like, are they people? Which is a theme that while Mary's Googling this, I can actually praise her, which comes up a lot in her own stories about AI. Are they human? Are they more than human? How do they interact with humans? So I can see the threads of her fiction and going all the way back to there, at least.
Yeah, and it was 1920 was I think what was written, but it may have been published in English in 1921. And I guess this is where our distinctions are maybe getting somewhat clouded, because I believe that with RUR, if I recall correctly, that's where the word robot is formed, but they're not
right.
It's not as explicitly machinic as, say, something that comes fairly and was, I think, fairly obviously influenced by it, like Metropolis, is a film we've talked about before, where the city is actually maintained by a machine whose consciousness is never really explored. So I guess that's a question that we probably should ask, is what do we mean when we say artificial intelligence? Do we mean, because I guess technically speaking, if we're talking about robots like that, obviously that applies. But Mary, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I still haven't found the book. But so that's actually the question of what is artificial intelligence is interesting, because a lot of the things that we have going now are arguably artificial intelligence, like Siri on your phone. She's interpreting what you're saying and making decisions, and people anthropomorphize, you know, they say she is doing these things. But in the science fiction sense, what people are looking for is something that is sentient. And that's not something, and I mean, scientists are still shooting for that. There's a common sense experiment where they are basically trying to teach a computer common sense. But that is not something that we have come close to achieving yet. We have lots of different things that have the individual components of consciousness. Like, they can react to light, they can react to pain, which is creepy in and of itself that they're building robots that can react to pain. I think when we're talking about artificial intelligence, we do have to decide whether or not we're talking about the fictional form or the stuff that's actually going on right now, or just the path there to artificial intelligence.
Yeah, and that's actually a really interesting distinction to kind of, because obviously a lot of what's being done with artificial intelligence in the real world is not the kind of stuff we tend to see in science fiction. They're creating programs that are capable of adapting to certain situations. You know, you get like military programs, but they're not trying to create like sentient computer machines. They're creating things that do certain tasks, or they do certain whatever. Whereas in a lot of science fiction, as you're saying, we were sometimes in the service of trying to create that thing that does a task. We end up inadvertently creating life. I think of a film probably none of you has seen called Colossus, The Forbin Project.
No, it's one of my favorites.
Okay.
From the 70s.
Yeah, somewhere around there. Yeah. No one's ever seen it. It's a familiar narrative. The basic point is it's set during the Cold War, and Americans have decided we're going to create this computerized system and connect all of our missile defense systems, everything to this system. It'll be the most advanced computer system ever. It'll be able to stop any attack, and that'll basically end all war, and that'll be the end. But what ends up happening is apparently the Russians, of course, the Russians, because they got, well, the Soviets, I guess they would have been, they create their own, and the two artificial intelligent computers start communicating, and it turns out that they're far more sentient than we thought, and those two computers decide, you know what? The best way to solve this is just to take over the world. So, and that, it's a really interesting film that kind of explores how this kind of inadvertent artificial intelligence pops up. Julie, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, okay. So I haven't seen that one, but it kind of reminded me of War Games, where in the end the computer is like, huh, there is no way to win this nuclear war game. We should play something else, which is cute. But what I was actually going to say was the first thing that I can think of that might be considered AI is TikTok of Oz, L. Frank Baum's character. Because, I mean, it's interesting because when I think AI, first what I think of are not hard bodies. And he's very much bound up in his body, but he has a gender. And Baum says he has no emotion and can't love or be loved. But he's very truthful and loyal as a servant. And he does interact with people. He speaks coherently and makes decisions based on what people tell him. So, I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, Mary, you found the thing you were talking about.
Yeah, well, I think we can still talk about TikTok. But, TikTok is arguably an artificial intelligence. And I guess one of the constraints would also be that it has to be man-made. I mean, by that standard, really anything that is artificially made, you know, that would you consider the Golem of Prague to be artificial intelligence?
I feel really stupid for not knowing what that is.
It's a story from 17th century, I think, Mary, about a rabbi that uses Kabbalistic magic to create a clay automaton to defend the Jewish community against pogroms and evildoers, except things go wrong as they always do. But I don't recall the Golem really having an inner life of its own.
No, it's I don't think it does either in most of the things that I've read. I think it was without thought. It was something that you turned loose. So by that argument, yes, you're right. It's not an artificial intelligence.
But I think that what's interesting about that, I'm not familiar with the story, so I'm going to profess complete ignorance and not know any specific details. But it is interesting, I think, that in the same way that we talk about past genres in regards to like science fiction, like when we talk about the formation of science fiction, and then we start applying like H.G. Wells and all these kinds of people to science fiction, even though their work was not science fiction at the time because the genre hadn't existed till, well, with Wells at least 15, 20 years later. It seems kind of like that's the same we're doing now, is because artificial intelligence doesn't, the concept doesn't exist until the 20th century, if I recall correctly. The actual term isn't used until then. So in a way, we can look at stuff like that particular story, the Golem story, as having kind of these rudimentary takes on concepts that still become relevant for a lot of AI-related work. I mean, you could even think there's some of that even in something like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, this creature that's made of a mishmash of body parts. It is a biological creature, but it still has some of those same deep-seated kind of concerns about what is life and the kind of questions of humanity, which I think AIs constantly bring up, in particular because AIs tend to be antagonists. You think of something like 2001, where the AI literally kind of goes berserk and nobody's really sure why. But yeah, it seems like in that kind of same way, we're looking back and seeing some of kind of the early ways of looking at it. Mary?
I'm glad that you mentioned the idea of things that were not artificial intelligence just because we didn't have the word, because that made me think of the Turk, the Mechanical Turk, which is an automaton from the late 1700s. And And it turns out it's actually an elaborate hoax that wasn't unveiled for years. But people thought that Wolfgang von Kempelen had created an artificial chess player, and that it was this elaborate wind-up automaton, and it would play chess and win against some of the best chess masters. And he would take it on tour and all over the place. People were completely fascinated with it, even when it lost, because it was mechanical. It turns out that actually there was an operator that was hiding inside it and working it. But this fascination with creating artificial life goes way, way back. I guess Pygmalion, technically.
And there's there's some of that even in the fairly recent Hugo with the mechanical man thingy, which is, you know, a throwing back to the older time. That's actually really interesting. I should note that the original apparently was destroyed in a fire, but the replica reconstruction is, I'm sorry, that's really creepy.
Isn't it? Just found pictures?
I just found pictures of on the wiki page I just gave everybody. There are a couple pictures of there's a reconstruction picture. And I'm sorry, I wouldn't play chess against that thing. That is really scary looking. Because he's not like I'm a nice guy who's wearing a turban. I look happy. No, I'm like, you look evil. I look mean. I'm going to hit you with the stick. He's holding some sort of, that's probably not a stick. It's probably a spear. Poke people in the eye. It makes me think, too, of, I'm sorry, kind of going to the magic thing, the film Big with the ambiguously intelligent Zoltar. Yeah. Also creepy figure, but it's also one of those moments where, I mean, is that machine intelligent? And if it is intelligent, what is it doing? It obviously has some sort of magic, but where does that intelligence come from? Is the question. Who the hell built that thing? Why don't we have a prequel for Big? I want to know who made this damn thing.
And why?
Yeah, just to mess with like 11-year-old boys that look like Tom Hanks? I guess that's the thing. I don't know. Julia, I see you put a hand up, so why don't you jump in?
Well, I don't really know what the origin story of Big is, but that brings up a good question about magic and machines and when that kind of where is the blurry line there? Because I'm not sure, is Zoltar intelligent, or is it just that there is some magic in the world and it is expressing itself by giving you a card through this particular machine today? So that's a question to ponder, but it reminded me of one of the greatest creepy AI things that I've seen, which was in an episode of a children's show called Eerie Indiana, which I discovered last year on Netflix streaming, and then, of course, they took it off before I had finished watching. But in this show, this kid moves from New Jersey to Eerie Indiana and finds that Eerie Indiana really lives up to its name. It is just really weird and creepy. And his father is working for this giant, like, scientific corporation that they have there and developing new things. And one of the things that he develops is an ATM. And this is actually before we had the kind of ATM that talks to you and sort of says, like, hey, how are you doing? What kind of transaction would you like to make? So this, at the time that they're actually making this show, that's not actually something we had yet. But this ATM does that. And everybody finds it pretty weird and creepy because it has this picture of this guy and he's kind of uncanny valley looking. And he looks at you out of his weird glasses and he's like, hi, how may I help you with this transaction? And so nobody decides to use this ATM except for the one boy's friend who is lonely. And the ATM, like, picks up on that immediately and is like, don't be lonely. I'll be your friend. Here, have $300. And this keeps happening until the guy that designed the ATM, the father of the main character of the show, gets into a lot of trouble because the bank is bankrupt.
Oh my.
But it's, if you haven't seen it, it's called The ATM with the Heart of Gold. It's an episode of Eerie Indiana, and it's definitely got the sort of machine intelligence, artificial intelligence. The machine is definitely sentient. It's super creepy. And I would say it's definitely not the kind of magic that we see in Zoltar. But I want to know your opinions on where the line is between kind of like magic versus AI.
Okay, I put my hand up because I just want to thank you right now, Julia. I was trying to find this exact show earlier this week, and I could not remember the title, and I kept Googling and could not find anything. And now I know. So thank you. Because as soon as you said Erie, Indiana, I was like, that's it. That's the name of the show. I kept looking up, like, Weirdville and just, yeah. So thank you.
No problem.
I guess I'll answer your question now since I went to my geek moment. I think that's a really good question because I find that there isn't – I think it depends what we're concerned with when we're talking about artificial intelligence because in actuality, there's a hell of a lot of artificial intelligence that probably most people don't even think is artificial intelligence. In a sense, I mean, all the internet has all kinds of little bots and things that just run around and do very simple tasks, but they do them automatically – which have a very, very, very simplistic, rudimentary form of intelligence, but they're not sentient. They're not running around thinking, doing things on their own. They're programmed to do a certain task. And I think that makes the line a lot more blurry when you start getting into, like, at what point is too simple not intelligent anymore? Because the other end of the scale, I guess you get to like the singularity and then they become so intelligent we don't understand them anymore or something like that. I see, Mary, that you might want to jump in on this one.
Well, yeah, I actually started running into this when I was writing my own fiction because there is so much, as you say, in our present world that we call artificial intelligence. Like the people who are working on it say, I work in artificial intelligence, and they're talking about making exactly the sort of things you're talking about, bots and stuff like that. And so I came up with a different term, which is artificial savant versus artificial intelligence. And the dividing line that I use in my own fiction is that an artificial intelligence is self-aware and capable of growth and change, and that an artificial savant is designed to do one task and do it very well, and it is not self-aware.
Ah,
I like that.
So
that would be a lot easier for us to kind of differentiate, you know, the point at which we've hit an artificial intelligence. I mean, that becomes the new question, right? Is when does it become an artificial intelligence and how do you determine that it is self-aware?
Exactly. It just pushes the question to a different point. At what point does something become self-aware? It's still a sticky question.
Nobody has an answer. I mean, Ray Kurzweil probably thinks he does, but. I like Kurzweil. He's a little kooky, but I'm not sure that he. I bet if you gave him an artificial intelligence and they like had a conversation, he would be very confused. I'm not sure he would know that what he's talking to, whether it's self-aware. I don't know if he would know. And I'm not even sure if like how much attention is actually being put into that question. I mean. I'm sure there are some people trying to do it, but it doesn't seem like it's a deep concern for most of the sort of communities. I mean, they're trying to create adaptive programs, but they're not necessarily concerned with self-awareness, at least broadly speaking. That seems to be more of a sort of ethical, intellectual side of things. Maybe that's just my take on it. Julia, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, so I actually was talking to, I have a friend who works in the MIT Media Lab, and so he knows all kinds of people who do different things with robotics, and they had been talking to a woman who, her specialty is ethics around robotics, and one of the things that they're lobbying for are laws to protect robots because people do humanize them, and she has a demonstration, which I think we might be able to see online, and I'll look for a link, and if I can find it later, I'll email it to you. You can maybe put it in the show notes, where she shows audiences robots, basically, and it actually really reminded me of Mary's demonstration where she can just turn anything into a puppet. Like, I've seen her take a boot and be like, this boot is now alive, and you're like, it's a boot, it was on your foot, now it is alive, okay, and then she's like, now I killed it. And all of the other puppets are going to look sad because the boot is dead. And the whole audience is just like, oh my God, that poor boot. because it's dead. So she does this with robots. And she has, like, I think dinosaurs. And they kind of, like, walk around and act like little dinosaurs. And they're cute. And then she makes people kill them. Like, makes people smash them. And this is clearly very damaging to us. So even if those bots aren't aware, and I think, as Mary said, that they're developing ones that can react to pain and things like that. So we are making robots that react to those things and they could become aware. But even before we get to that point, I think it's important for humans, just because we are us and we humanize other things, to not damage things that we consider human.
I have to say, this is where the puppetry comes in. Again, one of the things that I have noticed from touring with puppets is that there is a desire with very young children to hit the puppet, to try and to damage the puppet. And I think that exactly that would happen with, as soon as we start having anything resembling artificial intelligences, you know, that people are going to use them as a way to explore things that are otherwise frowned on by society. And at that point, you know, if we start going towards a place where AIs are actually self-aware, then we've just created another class of other.
Mm. Well, and that's certainly one of the central fears about a truly artificial self-aware intelligence, is not just the threat that they could pose in terms of physical, like with Colossus, where they can control our nuclear capabilities and they could basically wipe us out, but even that fear of something that is so much like us in some way, or even capable of surpassing us, and that goes to kind of this, I think, ingrained terror of inferiority that has probably been in humans since the dawn of time. And AIs do that, since, of course, AIs in many respects are better than us in certain things. I mean, I don't know many people who are as good at as Googlebots as surfing on the internet, but there you go. So,
yeah, and that, I mean, that is one of the tricky things, is that, and really one of the things that science fiction and fantasy allows us to do is to think about these questions before they become an issue. You know, think about the fact that if we actually create self-aware creatures, that we are essentially creating a slave race, and thinking about how to deal with that ethically and well before it becomes a reality. I suspect that despite all of the exploration that science fiction and fantasy authors do, that the politicians will completely ignore it, and people will get to this point and be like, no one has thought about this at all, and do stupid things.
And someone who, you know, because we do currently have a president who's a science fiction fan, some senator would be there and just like truck out the whole range of books on this very subject. Be like, well, clearly you're not reading.
Yeah.
Not surprising, since nobody reads the bills in Congress anyway. So, Paul, you've been waiting to jump in, so why don't you jump in on this?
Okay, I wanted to go back a little bit and go on a slightly different angle on this. The use and rise and development of, to use Mary's term, artificial savants is pretty clear. They make our lives easier. They automate tasks that we would find distasteful, boring,
tedious.
But why do you think there is a push in fiction and in real life to develop true artificial intelligences? Why do we want that, do you think?
Anyone in particular, or is that like to everybody?
That's to everybody.
Well, I'll just do a quick answer. I think it goes to the kind of human interest in just doing something because we can. Maybe that's not the whole motivation, but maybe a part of it.
Yeah, I would agree that I think it's related to the desire to create. Some of it is just the curiosity of, you know, can I do this thing? But I think a lot of it really is the desire to create and have some control over life, over what's happening. God complex.
Going back to Frankenstein, the modern Prometheus, and his desire to create life because he can and wants to. He wants to show he can.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that that's actually – I mean, a lot of what was going on in Frankenstein, though, initially was not just the desire to show that he can, but as a way to initially it was starting as his initial motivations before he went off the deep end into crazy land was a desire to try to understand death and how the human body worked. And to that end, he wanted to create the monster to see, you know, whether or not all of these theories and things worked. And certainly that is the case with some of the early automatons. There was somebody made a, and this is again in the 1700s, they made a duck that could eat and digest and poop. And some of it was wanting to understand how that worked.
Huh.
That's creepy.
Yeah. People are nuts.
So are you suggesting that the very first, before we decided we would make like toy babies for kids that like burp and stuff, they did it with a duck.
Oh yeah.
That's hilarious. I'm just mad. That's adorable, creepy, and hilarious all at once. Julie, I know you've been wanting to jump in, so go for it.
Okay, well, it seems like there are two different things going on here. And one of them is the, can we make this thing, how does it work? Which I think is behind, for instance, the Fur Real Friends that I recently bought off of eBay used and plan to turn one of them into a purse to carry to the Hugo ceremony so that I can have not just a kitten purse, but an animatronic kitten purse that will purr if you rub its face.
May I just say that is terrifying and creepy, and I can't wait to see it.
It is super terrifying. The animatronic cat, I have two of them. Only one has batteries, so I haven't heard the other one. The first one is a first generation, and it has the most uncanny meow ever. It says, meow! And whenever it does that, my actual cat just looks really freaked out. Like, what is that thing, and why is it here? But the second thing that I would say, and I think this comes through a lot in Mary's work that I've read that touches on AI, is that there's a combination of awesome things going on with AI if we could actually have them and do them well. One is it's this amazing companionship that is pretty much unlimited. It never ends. You can bounce stuff off of it. And if you're like me and you do your best thinking in deep conversation with friends, having the AI who you can just kind of bounce ideas off endlessly and will talk to you and form intelligent responses and help you work through your own processing is really attractive. And the second thing is they compile all kinds of experiences. So you have in For Want of a Nail, the robot that is kind of failing and having a hardware issue and that kind of turns into artificial intelligence Alzheimer's. The reason why that's so devastating, aside from the fact that the family has sort of looked at this person as one of them for a long time, is that they're also losing all of the memories that the family has experienced. And I think that also in the other one that was Hugo nominated with the police department that goes and uses the AI, if you have an artificial intelligence who can really compile all the video and all the visuals and all the audio of everything that you've done and help you process them, that is very, very useful to someone who's trying to do police work and detective work. If you have smart robots that can analyze everything and tell you, here are some patterns I recognize, does this seem useful, and focus on them and help you sort through and find the important things. I mean, why wouldn't we want that?
And to some extent, we have some of that now. I mean, you think some of the technology that's available to, I'm not all the police, but certainly certain branches of the police, things that do facial recognition searches, on video, they use some of this, I think, in the most recent, the Boston case, where they just had all of these pictures and videos and they obviously couldn't trove through it all. They had something like gigs and gigs of just stuff that they had to go through. And I'm sure that they use some automated computer systems to try to look through there to find commonalities. But Mary?
Yeah, and that's actually a really good example of artificial intelligence that is present in our society today. Last summer, I attempted to take, Stanford has an Introduction to Artificial Intelligence class that you can take online, which is an amazing thing. And I got two classes into it and realized I didn't have the math. But one of the things that it talks about is how to set up the sort of questions that an AI would have to go through to come back with an answer. And it was really interesting to see the places where, you know, a human would just kind of look at stuff and automatically jump to a decision. But for an AI, you have to break it down into all of these different steps that we do on a totally unconscious level. And once you get the AI doing it, it of course is happening essentially on an unconscious level for the AI, particularly since they aren't sentient yet. But but it's interesting that I think part of what is going on with the AI, with certain researchers, is a desire to understand how these things work, and which actually brings me to the other thing, that one of the things that is also really interesting in terms of how we talk about human intelligence is that our understanding of it and our way of describing it changes based on the existing technology. So, you know, before we had geared things, no one talked about feeling like their brain was switching gears.
That's a good point. I'd never even thought about that before.
Yeah, metaphors and our conception of human intelligence, geez, go some gears. Now we think of circuits. Oh, and you're right, Mary. And maybe there's something about, as we try to develop and work through artificial intelligence, we're trying to come to grips with the nature of our own in some ways. Since we are making leaps and bounds, but still, human intelligence is still a, to pardon the phrase, a vast, unexplored frontier.
Yeah, and I just want to offer a correction, because I was using the Boston. I'm not actually sure if they use facial recognition with Boston. I know that the police or the FBI or some of those organizations use it. I'm not sure if they actually did it in that case. I just don't want anybody to think that I said something that's totally BS, because this isn't, you know, certain news networks.
Well, they certainly use something, because they did have just a ton of footage and videos and photos and all sorts of stuff. And they were saying, you know, please, if you have video or photos of the finish line, please send them to us. And they had something going through all of that and probably looking for the packages in particular, I would imagine.
Yeah, there was something that they were doing. I don't know how they were doing it, but I realized that since they didn't have faces to look for until after they had figured out who it was, that they couldn't actually use facial recognition because they didn't know who to look for. So
no, but they had the remnants of the bags. So, for instance, they knew they were looking for black backpacks.
Mm, and they could probably, I imagine that they have a way of it, with the technology of, you know, telling it to look for objects about yay size that are that color, and they can kind of trove through and find them. Who knows? Yeah.
Yeah, well, and they'd also be able to, once they identified people who were carrying them, hand those faces to facial recognition and say, find this person in other images.
Yeah, and they can get a sense of which direction did they come from, et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah.
And see, if they were on TV, they could say, enhance, enhance.
That's true. They just did this in this is the thing I don't really understand, is while I understand that you can enhance images, that has to depend on certain factors that have to already exist within the image. So like I've been watching The Following, and there's this kind of funny moment where they go to like podunk town in the middle of nowhere, and they've got surveillance video from some thing where one of the killers was spotted, and the guy's going, oh, well, I can't make it any better. I can't tell if it's really the person because it's not, the color's not right, and it's just all like grainy. And the guy's like, here, just give me the computer. And he's like, I'll just type in my access codes to the FBI and just done. And the video is all of a sudden, it's perfect, crystal clear. And my thought was that can't be possible, because how is it figuring out how to fill in the pixels?
Pixel technology.
Right, because if the video is grainy, that means that the quality of that video has a certain limitation. So at some point, the computer, I mean, maybe they're using advanced, like, pixel guessing software. I don't know. It was weird. But that happens a lot, actually, in a lot of sort of cop shows, and The Following is kind of one of these where it has actually a lot more technology. It's weirdly fantastic. This whole show is really weird, but also kind of awesome. So, sorry, that was a tangent.
Well, no, because, I mean, that's an example of something that, in theory, artificial intelligence would actually be able to do. That it would be able to look at all of these different frames and use them to try to enhance an image and create a composite. And, you know, there's a lot of really good stuff that people can do with composite images. The stuff that happens on television, no. But there is the potential that if you had an artificial intelligence a true one, that it could do. Actually, it wouldn't even have to be a true one. If you had, there is the potential that you could certainly clean things up far more than we have the ability to do now. But yeah, you can't invent information that's not there.
Not yet.
Well, I mean, you can invent information that's not there, but that is my job.
It is really actually kind of cool. I'm trying to think if Minority Report had the film version, not the story, had artificial intelligence. But now I'm just thinking it maybe just had that really cool screen system. It had to. No, because the cars were automated. And so some sort of system had. I mean, obviously, we're not talking about it's an artificial savant, just to use Mary's term. But that whole highway system has to be maintained to a T, because those cars are moving probably like 200 miles an hour, and one car gets out of place, it's boom, you know, death, destruction. So, oh gosh, we should have a novel. There should be like a movie about that very thing, where it's an all, like, that's the apocalypse, is suddenly all of our comforts with artificial intelligence, they just stop functioning. And so you've got like Live and Die, the new Die Hard movie, not the Russian one, the one from a few years ago. Live or Die Hard?
Live Free or Die Hard.
There you go. Live Free or Die Hard. But instead of, you know, people shutting it down in a relatively non-AI central city, have one where everything is automated and then all of a sudden it shuts down. And so your highway system is like carnage because all the cars have just crashed into each other at 200 miles an hour and your trains have flown off the tracks. That would be slightly terrifying.
More than slightly.
Yeah.
That would be bad.
I wouldn't recommend it. Don't do that to anybody.
Oh, sorry. My cat just let me know that I was not paying attention to her and startled me.
Usually it's Sean's cat who interrupts us during the podcast.
He's been remarkably good this time. Although he's doing something over there that I don't know what.
Yeah, she's doing the whole, you are not petting me, but you are sitting down.
It's lap time. Lap time.
So since we're paused, let me tell you about that French book that I brought up at the beginning and couldn't remember the title of.
Okay.
It's from he started writing it in 1878. It was actually published in 1886. I am not going to try to say the French title because I don't speak French. But it's often translated as Tomorrow's Eve. I'm going to have to say the author's name. Crap.
If you hold on a second, like maybe you could type it in. I actually could probably pronounce it.
Thank you. There are French is that why do they use all of those letters when they aren't going to pronounce them all?
They ask the same thing about English, by the way, just in case you were wondering. Auguste Villiers de l'Isle Adam. Yeah. Gotcha. Auguste Villiers de l'Isle Adam.
Cool. Interesting.
Thank you. Anyway, so basically in this, he posits that that Thomas Edison has created an artificial person. This is actually where the term android comes from. It's the first time, or it's, I guess it's popularized. He creates this artificial woman for this guy who wants the perfect wife, and it's all talking about the discs that go into her, the cables and things like this, and how she can't get too far away from certain things because She has to be wound regularly because she needs the cables and the pistons and the gears that drive her. And in the, I think the first time we see her, there's this enormous, massive infrastructure underneath the building that she's kept in that make her run. And then later it's miniaturized as a way to, you know, well, we only need her to do these things. But she's, it's really weird. They do, I think, eventually, she's not sufficient, so they transplant somebody's spirit into her.
Oh, that's creepy.
Yeah, it is.
Also kind of cool, but creepy. It should just be noted that his name is a lot longer than the one you just gave us. So I'm going to, just as for humor's sake, I want to see if Julie can pronounce this. That's his full name.
Okay. That doesn't surprise me at all. That's very French.
Yeah.
Jean-Marie Mathias Philippe Auguste Comte de Villiers de l'Isle d'Adam. I keep wanting to say de l'Isle d'Adam, but like to add a D between. But so that I would be saying of the Isle of the Adam, but instead it's just of the Isle Adam. But yes, it's a very French name. It's a very noble French name with just add extra names in the middle.
It's so, and this was in 1886, I think, was the year.
Yeah, yeah, that's when it actually was printed. He started writing it though, in 1878.
Yeah,
yeah, and actually, it reminds me of a story that doesn't. It's not exactly on topic because there isn't. I don't think there's really artificial intelligence in it. But as far as like really weird kind of futuristic stuff, that's sort of on target. And has a lot of infrastructure, and what made me first think of it was when Sean was talking about, like, you know, stopping all your computers and all your cars crash and the trains derail. And it's called The Machine Stops. It's by E.M. Forster. I think it's a novelette, and it was published in the early 1900s. And it's basically about a world where everybody lives on the internet. You have your little apartment that you never leave, and you do your own things in your one little room, but mostly you just spend your time on the internet hanging out, and people are well known for their virtual lectures and things. And the problem is that everybody's gotten so caught up in it that nobody is bothering to keep up with making sure that the actual infrastructure that keeps society working is working. And they've run out of resources and the machine is stopping and everyone's going to die.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
It's actually, I'm surprised nobody's read this other than Julie and I myself. So. Oh, okay. There's also a BBC adaptation of it. I forgot the name of the TV show it was part of, but if you just Google on YouTube, you can watch it. It's about an hour. It's a fairly literal translation, in case you would rather watch the very bizarre late 60s version, where the sets must have been made out of like cardboard. But it's
Doctor
actually...
Doctor Who sets, you mean?
Doctor Who sets, exactly. No, I haven't seen that. That's fascinating.
It's
the
actually not
thing
bad.
Is that, of course, they don't call it the internet because we didn't have internet in the early 1900s.
No, but it is very much like that. And if you and in the story, there's a religious component because the two characters that the kind of main characters is a mother and her son. But in this world, you have babies and then they go off, they get taken to another part of the machine and they're like raised. There is no like parental thing. There's kind of an underlying subtext that's kind of what's going on, is the parental instinct is she's fighting against it. But in any case, they spend all of this time in this machine, which is automated to take care of them. And to the point where they basically have become almost like fat flesh blobs in their little chairs, and they sit around and in the case of the mother, she does these lectures about like really obscure Australian orchestra and all kinds of weird stuff. And then when the machine stops, there's the religious component is that she starts as this non-religious person and then she starts to worship the machine in this really, really kind of creepy way by the end. It's an incredible story for, I think it was 1908. Yeah. And it is going to a lot of that artificial intelligence because the machine is supposed to be automated. It's supposed to do everything that people need, and it even makes sure to get rid of people that it considers to be deviant. The machine automatically does this. And Audra won't ruin anything else about this story, because clearly two of the people in here have not read it, and they should. I don't want to ruin anything, but it's a really interesting story. And then you can go watch the BBC version, so, which is fairly faithful, and you can tell which one of the the actors has been on the stage, because there's very much that kind of stagey acting style, that very like almost like Shakespearean theater. Yeah,
declaiming.
Yeah,
there's nothing wrong with a little declaiming.
Oh no, it's actually very interesting, because there's a lot of monologues. It's not like a lot of our science fiction today, where it's, you know, in a Michael Bay version of The Machine Stops, 3 minutes in there would have been an explosion, and then a transformer would come out of the ground and like suck somebody up. Yeah,
there'd probably be a half naked girl too.
There has to be a half naked girl. It's a Michael Bay movie.
Who's strangely been covered in grease, so she glistens in the sun. Yeah. That's Michael Bay's movies. Except for The Island. The Island's the only one that doesn't do that. In fact, in The Island, the one main female love interest beats the crap out of the main actor. Just thought you should all know that.
I've seen The Island. I was trying to see how I could connect that with our topic and failing. That, I mean, clones are not really artificial intelligences, though. They're people, but... But there is the question of human rights for clones. I mean,
Well, actually, it does connect, because there's a certain... Oh, shoot, what is this called? It turns up in science fiction a lot, where it's where they try to create... You know, they grow things in bats. But organic computing?
Where, oh, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, arguably that's another form of artificial intelligence. And
DNA and computers, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Creepy.
So creepy.
But also, again, kind of cool. Julia?
Well, so I'm just wondering, we're kind of running up on the end of our hour of prescribed talk time, but I don't think we've actually taken time to say what our favorite AI in SF is, and I'm really curious to hear what your responses are.
Okay, well, why don't we start with you, Julia?
I think I already said mine, which is the creepy ATM from that episode of Gary, Indiana.
Fair enough. All right, Paul?
I can't remember the name, the actual name of the actual AI in it, but I was thinking of the AI in Stand on Zanzibar. I can't remember the name of the computer, though. Because it is sentient, and that's okay. I'm just spoiled Stand on Zanzibar, but for our listeners, but yes, it turns out the computer is sentient, and getting the computer to understand what's going on is part of the plot. But I don't think the computer actually has a name.
We'll have to maybe if somebody knows, they can send in a comment and clarify. Mine would have to be probably a tie between the AIs from Colossus, the Forbin Project, because I find those rather compelling. And also from I Have No Mouth, But I Must... I Have No Mouth, But I Must Scream. Is that the exact title?
I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream.
I Must Scream. AM is the name of the AI from that, who is... in all respects, more alien than AIs would normally be, because he takes pleasure in torturing humans. But part of the problem is figuring out why does he take pleasure in it, since he's an AI who claims that he has no feeling, but yet he feels so intense of hate for the humans he's allowed to live. It's a great story. Not read it. So, Mary?
R. Daniel Olivaw from Asimov. So, Caves of Steel, Naked Sun, Robots of Dawn, the robot detective, and just in case the fact that this is my favorite is not obvious, I was very much thinking about the relationship between him and Elijah Bailey when I was writing the Kiss Me Twice.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah.
Right, Mata and Huang. Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense now that you pointed it out.
And I should say, like, I love Meta. Meta is one of my other favorite AIs.
Thank you.
Oh,
also,
by the way,
one more. Oh, sorry. Just, I thought of one more that's awesome, and that's the AI that Kevin Spacey voices in the movie Moon.
Oh, yeah.
He voices that?
No.
Yeah, it's Kevin Spacey.
Yeah, it's Kevin Spacey. He's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh,
like the Knight's version of Hal.
Oh, yeah. No, that's an amazing one. Yeah, that's a really good example.
That's so interesting. Or you could even think of Jarvis from the Iron Man movies, not the Jarvis from the comics.
Yeah.
It's a different Jarvis.
Yeah.
The name of the AI in Sin on Zanzibar is Shalmaneser.
Hmm.
Of course, you would have to have like this really cool name.
Oh. Max Headroom.
Oh, if we're going to go on cheesy 80s, I have to bring up Synergy, the computer that powers Gem and the Holograms.
Oh, yeah.
Which, if you're not familiar with the premise of that show, it is super, super cheesy, over-the-top SF.
Yeah.
Basically, Gem is a regular woman named Jerrica Benton, but when her father dies, he leaves her an AI computer which has, like, random piano keys scattered around its face. And it has the power to create holograms, which are apparently actually like solid and you can feel them, of clothing and various instruments and things. So Jem and her friends have a rock band, and Jerrica has special earrings, and whenever she wants to change into Jem, she says "Showtime, Synergy," and presses her earring, and the hologram AI turns her into Jem and is able to like keep this moving hologram projection indefinitely.
That's some fantastic battery life is what that is.
It makes hologram clothing that the whole band gets to wear.
That's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, okay, so before we digress into more of this, although this is interesting, learning about what everybody likes in terms of their favorite AIs, we should just take a moment to talk about the fact that, Mary, you have supposedly written some sort of a book or something at some point recently that came out at the beginning of last month. And I thought it would be a good time for you to tell us about this new book, which I recall the title is Without a Summer, correct?
That is correct. There is absolutely no artificial intelligence in it anywhere. it is basically, these are historical fantasy. The reason it's called Without a Summer is because it's set in the historic year, the year without a summer, which is 1816. In 1815, a volcano, Tambora, went off and threw up so much ash into the air that we had global cooling. People at the time didn't know that that's what was going on, but it was so bad that we had snow in Washington, D.C. in July. Oh, and actually, you know what? This does tie into artificial intelligence. Because Mary Shelley was on vacation with her friends in Italy, and they stayed inside because of all of the cold, gloomy weather. And you read about this and you think, huh, but it's August. And it was because it was 1816 and she was stuck in the middle of the year without a summer. So anyway, Mary Shelley and Frankenstein are not in my book. But it was a chance to tie it back to the topic. The magic system is called glamour. My main characters are professional glamorists, which is a form of illusion. Unlike Jim and the Holograms, you cannot actually touch glamour. You can't feel it. It is purely illusionary. And I described the book when we were pitching it as kind of like Jane Austen's Emma against the Luddite Rebellion. So it's got political unrest, a lot of snow, and magic.
And set during a year that I had not heard of, which now I am deeply fascinated by.
It is really cool. There's a great book called The Year Without a Summer that just came out this year, which I recommend.
You've read it? I've heard about it, but I haven't picked it up yet.
I'm not all the way through it. You know, it came out after I wrote my book, which it would have been really handy if it had been while I was writing it. But it's well written and has a nice narrative flow as well, so...
There's also a great song by Rasputina about that year.
Yes, it keeps turning up in my Google alerts.
So excellent. So, and this is the third book, I believe, in this series, correct?
That is correct. So the overall series is called The Glamorist Histories, and we kind of described them as like Jane Austen with magic. The first one is Shades of Milk and Honey, and it's very much the Jane Austen plot mold. The second one, I broke out of that glamour and glass, and it's in the days leading up to the Battle of Waterloo. So secretly, it is a spy novel, but, you know, if Jane Austen were writing it, and so there's still a lot of drawing room. This one is secretly a political thriller, and book four, which comes out in 2014, called Valor and Vanity, I pitched it as Jane Austen writes Ocean's 11.
Oh, that sounds awesome. So out of curiosity, potentially stupid question, but why, what is it for you about this time period that was so interesting? Why did you decide to write, you know, kind of playing with the Jane Austen's milieu, or even just the general period, even specifically for this book? I mean, obviously, because you're dealing with a kind of bizarre year, but even more specifically, the 19th century.
Sure. The Regency was a time of great social change. You're coming out of, you know, you've got all of the Napoleonic Wars, the French Revolution. This is really the first time that you start to see people being able to move between social classes. So you've got these soldiers who are coming back, these military captains who have made their fortune at sea and coming back, and you have the rise of the middle class. And it's also one of the periods that, despite our impression from Jane Austen, had some of the most relaxed social conventions for women, and you can see that in the clothing. Before that, the clothing is, you know, you've got the paniers. It's all very structured and doesn't allow women a lot of freedom of movement. In the Regency, you basically have people wearing like three nightgowns. So it's really very easy to move. You can actually dress by yourself. And then you come out of that into the Victorian era, where there's again this this much more rigid structure in terms of what women are allowed to do. One of the places that you can kind of see this in Jane Austen is in Sense and Sensibility. Marianne goes out with Wickham several times, unchaperoned. And that is not an issue. The fact that she is without a chaperone is not an issue. The issue is when he takes her to the house that he owns as if they are engaged. So it's really interesting. And the fact that there is that social change and that potential just makes so many interesting story opportunities.
I absolutely agree that Jane and Vincent are fascinating characters with fascinating characters revolving around them. It's a nice little orrery of characters and conflict and world building. I heartily recommend Mary's Regency novels to everyone. I admit when we were proposing this topic, I thought, well, we could talk about that, but the reason why I want to talk about AI is because you've written stories, and I don't think you get enough credit for being a science fiction author as well as being a fantasist, which is why I pitched this topic to Sean rather than talking more explicitly about your novels at length.
It's interesting that you say that, and thank you, by the way. Because I do write all over the map in short fiction, but at a certain point I made the very conscious decision to focus a little bit more on science fiction in my short form and fantasy in the long form. And the reason was because when I was looking at what sold and listening to editors talk, I kept hearing editor after editor say that in short fiction, they did not have enough science fiction, and they didn't have enough science fiction by women. Long form, fantasy was hot. And it was very, very hard for a woman to sell a science fiction novel. So I actually, Kiss Me Twice actually started life as a novel.
Right. You showed people that on your, some people that on your blog, the novel version. I remember that.
Well, it started as a novel, and then I cut it down to the novella, and then I have expanded it back out to novel length. And, you know, and we're going to try shopping it, and we'll see whether or not people will go for me writing science fiction in long form.
I'd buy it.
Yes, but you're wonderful.
Thank you.
Now I feel like saying I'm going to buy it, because I'll probably buy it because I like science fiction.
You are also wonderful. All of you are wonderful.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I believe Julia has a question, too.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I guess one of the things that I think is interesting is that in all of Mary's glamorous histories, the pitch is always Jane Austen does X. But what I found about them is that they really, aside from the first one, go into a lot of different issues that are going on in the world in a way that if you look at Jane Austen's novels carefully, you can kind of see that those things are going on in the background, but it's really, really not in the foreground, and you have to know all about the era in order to figure it out. And so, like, especially in this latest one, you have anti-Catholic sentiment and the Luddite Revolution. Can you talk a little bit about how you decided to approach all of that?
Yes. Well, it was actually inspired by Jane Austen. One of the things that you said, which is very true, is that there's this stuff going on in the background of Jane Austen, but you have to really know the period to understand it. Well, the people that Jane Austen was writing for knew the period because they were living in it. So a lot of this stuff was a little bit more forefront than we're reading it. And one of the things that Austen does in Emma in particular is that she has Emma be completely oblivious to the fact that there are servants. And there are a whole bunch of these sly little things, like Emma talks about how the weather is absolutely terrible and the sort of day that no one wants to go out in, and it's only good for sending messages back and forth, which are, of course, carried by servants. There's another point where someone comes up the drive carrying someone else, and absolutely no one was on the drive except for these two as the great gates opened. And of course, there are servants opening the gates. And so she does this all the way through, where she talks about the actions of the servants, but Emma is completely oblivious to the fact that they exist. So kind of, and Emma is also very much about Emma was dealing with her own prejudices of class all the way through that book. The whole thing is Emma dealing with class. So with the Luddite Rebellion, and with 1816, one of the things that I kept running across while I was doing research were all of these class issues, that a lot of what was going on, were things that there were changes in tax structure and a lot of other stuff. I don't get into the tax structure because taxes are dull. that were having a direct impact on the lower class. And so what I wanted to do was to kind of take a look at that and talk about it in ways that a modern reader could access a little bit more readily. The other thing with the Luddites in particular, the Luddite movement has really actually kind of wound down more or less by this point in 1813, I think it is, because they executed a lot of people, which, you know, kind of limits the activities you can do. But the thing that was interesting about the Luddites, I had always thought about Luddites as being people who feared technology, because that is how we tend to use it today. And that is not actually what was going on. Or rather, it wasn't that they feared technology because it was technology. The problem was that the weaving looms, which were the big thrust that the Luddites were fighting against, were disrupting the social structure. Prior to that, all the weaving had been done in the home. And although the word factory was used, you would go and you would pick up stuff, and you would take it home and you'd weave it at home, which meant that you didn't need childcare. And it was a job that was passed down from generation to generation, and it was skilled labor. Enter the weaving looms, which are automated. And actually, Jacquard in 1806 created punch cards. This was looms that you could put a punch card in, it would do whatever pattern you introduced it to. So early computers. And it suddenly became unskilled labor that you did outside of the home, so you needed childcare and completely disrupted the social fabric. So that was a lot of what was going on with the Luddites. So these were different pieces that I wanted to play with. And then the other thing, and this is me, and my own personal journey, is that I wanted to set the book in London. And one of the things one of the pieces of dialogue that keeps coming up in the science fiction and fantasy community is how very white it is. And London was not, you know, granted, it was still, you know, racism and segregation, but it was a cosmopolitan city. There were people of color everywhere. And one of the other things that I ran across was the Cato Street conspiracy. When I was looking for how treason was handled in law, and ran across this, and it's actually in the 1820s. But one of the heads of the conspiracy was a man of color. And one of the things that surprised me was that the period correct term was man of color, person of color, woman of color. The other thing that didn't surprise me so much as just sort of like, oh, nothing has really changed, is there's a point in the trial transcripts where someone says, you know, you were seen going over this bridge. And he said, no, I wasn't. Are you certain you didn't mistake me for some other man of color? We are frequently mistaken for each other.
Oh, ouch.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right. So I wanted to deal with all of the different, you know, deal with as many different layers of prejudice as I could. So that's what I did.
This is also period, if I recall correctly, because I think in roughly the 1810s, in another 15-20 years, the United Kingdom, or at least the British Empire, I believe, outlaws slavery.
Slavery is already outlawed in England.
Oh, okay.
So any slaves that set foot on English soil are free. Slavery in the colonies is still permitted at this point in history. That is something that I use with the coldmongers, that in London, the coldmongers tend to be people of color, or because there were, coldmonger, I should explain for people who have not read the books. Coldmongering is a form of glamour in which you can cool things a little bit, but it takes a really hard toll on your body, so it tends to be something that people of lower class do. And in the Americas, and previously in England's history, it was something that was primarily done by slaves. So in London in particular, most of the coldmongers are people of color because they're descendants of slaves.
Yeah, and I you were right that I believe it's 1772 is when the first, like, ruling basically emancipates slaves that are in England. And it's 1883 when the entire empire banishes slavery, at least legally. Of course, that probably takes some time for people to catch on. But I was in the kind of sort of ballpark.
Yeah. No, it was pretty good. I've been reading about it because for book five, I send them to the West Indies.
And,
ooh,
that'll be interesting.
Yeah,
that's exciting.
Cool. Well,
so
okay.
One more little thing before we move on. And talking about the fact that there were people of color all over the place in London at the time, in the book, you actually have Jane encountering a woman of color at Almack's, which is the mm-hmm. big place where everybody goes to dance. And if you've read Regency romances, which I suspect a lot of the people who have read this series have, you know that name because that's where everyone goes to go meet people and have their very polite society dances and make good connections. But I don't think that I had ever read another Regency romance that actually had any people of color there.
Yeah, this is one of the interesting things. So she is what was called Anglo-Indian. And one of the interesting things about the East India Company is that these British men would go to India and be there for years, you know, decades. And they would often get married. And then they would send their children back to England to be educated. So these are children of extraordinarily wealthy men. And usually, not always, I mean, there was definitely prejudices going on, but people would look over what they called a touch of the tawny if you had a sufficient bank account. Because, of course, they had a British father. Now, here's the other interesting thing. If they had a British mother, they usually were educated in India and tended to be lower class. Because they married an Indian man.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and power comes from the father.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, it's fascinating and totally messed up.
Which basically means that I would be totally cast out because my father is Mexican. My mother is the white woman.
Yep.
All right. So next year is going to be book 4.
Mm-hmm. Valor and Vanity.
And then supposedly I swear you mentioned you're writing another book after that.
I may have slipped. Yes. Oh.
She did mention a fifth book set in the West Indies, which
that's right.
Paul and I are drooling over now.
Yeah.
So
this is, I will say that this book is not sold. We have talked about it. So this is a book that may not actually happen. I'm in the research phase and the discussion phase with editor.
Does it have a working title?
Of Noble Family.
All right.
All right. Cool. All right. So this new book
Without a Summer.
Thank you.
Which is the one that you can actually go and buy.
Yes. One. Well, actually, you can buy all three. Now, Without a Summer is only in hardcover at the moment, and ebook. Mm-hmm. And audiobooks, but that's true. But all the others are basically in every format imaginable at this point, except maybe mass market. But
that is, yeah, it's, we're just doing trade paperback for these.
That's fine, because mass market would not do the covers justice, so it would make it all tiny. It's not right.
Yeah, have you seen the Amazon? I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Paul.
Have you seen the Amazon UK cover for of Shades of Milk and Honey?
It's beautiful.
I mean, mm-hmm. no offense to the U.S. edition, Mary, but I feel the Amazon UK version, the UK version is much more thematically tied to the other novels.
Well, that's because we are using the art of Larry Ronstadt, who has done the covers for the rest of the series. The first book in America, the art is actually from 1804. And then they decided to rebrand the books. And I love Larry Ronstadt's work. He's just doing beautiful, beautiful things. And is actually, I have to say, so excited because in Without a Summer, and I just saw the cover for Valor and Vanity, he actually has some of the characters on the covers wearing outfits that I have described in the book.
Yeah, and Without a Summer, there's that's a described outfit.
Yeah. I was so excited by that.
I was super excited when I saw that. So I want to say to anyone who's thinking about buying these but is daunted by the idea of a series that I have read all of them and they all stand alone. You can actually pick up any one in the series and read it. You may have minor spoilers for things that happen in other books, but that shouldn't actually detract from your enjoyment of reading them if you decide afterwards that you want to go out of order and read the other books.
However, the better course of action would be just to buy all three at the same time.
Well, you are wonderful. I will say thank you, Julia, for mentioning that. But I did work really, really hard on making sure that you could read these books out of sequence. They do follow, you know, they do 1814, 1815, 1816, et cetera. But I worked hard to keep the spoilers out so that you could go back and read the other books as prequels. Unavoidably, you will know who gets married to whom at the end of the first book. Kind of hard to keep that one out. But I tried to keep out all of the other stuff.
That's going to actually be really hard as a writer to make what is essentially a series but have them so separate in themselves that you could read them out of order.
I can tell you how to do that, but that would probably be a whole other podcast.
As you say on your other show, Can of Worms, right?
Can of Worms.
So really quick then, to let everybody know, where can they find you?
They can find me at maryrobinettekowal.com, which is very long. Sorry about that. I'm assuming you have show notes, or do you want me to spell that?
I'll put it in the show okay, notes. Great. Yeah, they'll be able to find it.
Right. And then on Twitter, I'm Mary Robinette, and you can find me on Facebook with the entire incredibly long name. And I'll just mention, just because we're here, Robinette is my middle name. So I grew up in the South. Mary Robinette was a double-barreled name. It is not my maiden name. Not that I am at all prickly about that.
You do have this thing on your contact form, which I thought was really amusing. It tells people how to address you, not calling you Mrs. Robinette Kowal. You don't want to be called that.
The hyphen. People hyphenate that. I'm like, there is no, do you see a hyphen anywhere on my page? No. I was at a con and I was registering, and you know, this happens pretty frequently, and I understand. I mean, Robinette is a surname, but it's just, it happens to be my middle name. So I understand when I get filed under Robinette instead of Kowal. And so, you know, they didn't have my registration under Kowal, and they looked under Robinette, and it was there, and it was hyphenated. And I'm like, can you please correct this in your database? And the woman says, oh, I was told very clearly that there was a hyphen. And I'm like, oh, God. It's my name.
Oh, God.
No, there is not.
I like how there's that hint. Like, I'm going to actually argue with you about how to spell your own name.
No. What? So it happens often enough that that's why I finally put this. I just had it in the FAQ, and I appreciate people wanting to be formal, but then I have to correct them and I feel bad. And
I always just, if I don't know if the person's married, I just put Miss or Mr. and last name. Well, with Mr. it doesn't matter because there's no married. There really should be. For the guys, there should be
yes, I agree. And again, this is a whole other podcast. My only problem with Miss and Mrs. is that there is not a similar marker for men.
Yeah, I think we should invent one. So that would be the next show, right? That's nothing to do with genre.
No.
So anyway, okay, so everybody should go check out your webpage. You should go get all of your books, including the new one. And they should also go check you out on Writing Excuses, which is nominated for an award. Among other things that you've done, have been nominated and won awards. But of course, if you want to get writing advice from Mary or Brandon Sanderson, Howard Taylor, and oh my God,
Dan Wells.
Yes. All four of them, they give lots of advice on various topics. You can also go through the backlist from like the dawn of time. And there's a lot of stuff in there. So that's that. So thank you, Mary, for coming on and talking with us about all of this stuff. It was really great.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a great deal of fun.
Cool.
Thanks.
And we will see everybody next episode.
Good night, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.